Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, good friends and neighbors. Good to see you back on the Bill Press Pod as we continue our four-part series on the American presidency. Again, our goal is to examine yesterday's presidents in order to help us make today's choice and the right choice for our next president. Again, as we point out every time, our goal is not to convince you to vote for Joe Biden. I know you've probably already decided that's what you're going to do. I certainly have. Our goal is just to put this choice in perspective, looking at the American presidency, to reinforce our own thinking about Donald Trump, and to provide us with some good ammunition we can use to convince our friends not to sit this one out and to take it very, very seriously and to get behind Joe Biden. Now, our goal for this in this four-part series, we're so lucky to have one of our leading presidential historians with us. I think he's the best, actually. Doug Brinkley, CNN historian, professor of history at Rice University, and author of several books on presidents and the presidency. Now, in our first segment, you may remember with Professor Brinkley, we asked what it takes to be president. What qualities should we be looking for in any candidate? Last week, we looked at those presidents whom historians rate among the best. What made them so great? Today, in our third segment, recognizing that nobody, not even a president, stands alone, we asked Doug Brinkley, how important are the people that a president surrounds himself with? If it does take a village, as Hillary said, which presidents have put together the best team? And of course, as we do every week, we'll flash forward to apply what we learned today to the big choice we have to make between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Doug Brinkley, welcome back to the Bill Press Pod, and welcome back to our series on American presidents and what they can tell us about a big decision we have today. Good to talk to you again, Doug.
Well, thank you for having me again.
So, you know, so far we've looked at those who've held the office of president and what we might learn from them to help us make our big decision this year. We looked at the qualities that we should be searching for in a candidate for president. We look at some of the greats and the not so greats. Today, I want to ask you to talk about the team that presidents surround themselves with. You know, as Hillary might say, it takes a village, right? So, but these are among the very first decisions that a president has to make, right?
Well, that's right. The group, the gang around the president, is particularly who's going to be the head of the White House staff. Mm-hmm. Tell us a lot about the tone and tenor of a particular administration. I find it, through my writings and studies, helpful when a president has a friend or two in government that can just tell them off, that could say that's dead wrong, that can, you know, speak truth to power, so to speak. It doesn't happen that often, but, you know, but when you find a collaborative team like that, James Baker was able to be that way with George Herbert Walker Bush, or the way that Ted Sorensen could be with John F. Kennedy, the way Harry Hopkins could be with FDR, and Eleanor, his own wife, could be that way. I mean, I think these are helpful to so presidents don't get in a bubble or think that they're holier, mightier than thou.
But that team around them, as you say, hopefully not filled with yes men or women, is extremely important in the running of the government, isn't it? I mean, again, those decisions really have a lot to do with the success of any president, correct?
No question about it. And, you know, certainly who's going to be representing you at State Department matters mightily? Who is your Treasury Secretary? Who is going to be working your foreign policy SWAT team, which is the NSC? And then just who are you getting your Svengali advice from? You're listening to somebody. Sometimes it's simply the spouse. I mean, it used to be called pillow talk presidency. First ladies we look at, you know, for like ones ranging from Dolly Madison to Eleanor Roosevelt to Lady Bird Johnson and Nancy Reagan. I mean, the amount of power a first lady has is immense because they have the ultimate power to persuade, and they spend the most time with the president.
Right. Yeah, I want to go back to some of those particular first ladies that you mentioned. But among the presidents, Team of Rivals, right, with Dorothy Kearns Goodwin's great book, is do we rate Lincoln as the one who put together the best team, or maybe FDR? You've written about both, of course.
I think if you had in that particular regard, I would give it to Abraham Lincoln, doing as Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote in Teams of Rival, was able to come in as president and then pick all the people that were against him and made them part of a cabinet, part of his team, so they would work together and not against each other for an ordeal that was coming, the Civil War. And it was a master stroke by Lincoln. FDR did something similar. He put a lot of Republicans into his presidency after 1940 election, when suddenly the Secretary of War was Henry L. Stimson, a Republican, or Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, Republican. You know, people sometimes don't realize that John F. Kennedy had put McGeorge Bundy was a Republican, and that was his national security advisor, and so was Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense. So, you know, it's often good to bring people in from the other party to show a kind of unity that's going on and ease people's wounds that they lost an election. But lo and behold, here are some key people they like that could be seen in government. It would be like if Joe Biden suddenly now put Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney in his government, you know, people. It starts feeling more like a unity government than just going with old-fashioned Democrats.
Hey, it could happen. So was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton sort of a Team of Rivals moment?
Yes, definitely. Barack Obama had read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals, and it gave him the idea that we've got to bring Hillary Clinton into the fold. There was no great love lost between the two of them. They developed a great professional relationship later, but he gave her the post of Secretary of State, and then most importantly, kept supporting Hillary Clinton when she decided to run for president. It's not often commented on, but it was Barack Obama who told Joe Biden, "Do not run." Mm-hmm. And you know, that Hillary Clinton's going to run in 2016. And so there's some strains now between the Obamas and the Bidens, the teams. They do talk. There is some interaction, but by and large, there's no love lost between them.
David Halberstam's great book, The Best and the Brightest, right, would lead us to believe that John F. Kennedy put together the best team in the White House. Do you share that?
He put together a fine team. I don't know to put the best. I would still go with Lincoln and FDR over what Kennedy did. But there was a feeling that Kennedy was interested in technocrats. And, you know, and certainly McNamara fit that billing. And then Douglas Dillon became Secretary of Treasury for Kennedy, and he used to be a Republican, or was a Republican at the time. Treasury is a big post to be handing out to somebody different. We have to remember Kennedy barely beat Nixon in 1960, really by a slender margin. And so that allowed, I think, the Kennedy to feel he needed to go across the aisle and find some talent from the other pool.
So obviously some of these positions are more important than others. I wanted to ask you particularly about, let's start with Secretary of State, right? I mean, when we think of Secretaries of State, some of them have gone on to become major historical figures on their own, right? A James Baker, a Henry Kissinger, right? Or Colin Powell.
Yeah, they're very true. You know, from the beginning of our country, I mean, Thomas Jefferson, Secretary of State, was seen for a while as an ultimate stepping stone to the White House. It subsequently has been less of that, but it's still an ultimate post to get. The, you know, that would be, for example, the only spot Hillary Clinton wanted was to be Secretary of State. I look at Secretaries of State, the greats of being Dean Acheson and George Marshall back in the Truman period. You had John Foster Dulles, who our airport is named after, because he died in office and there was a lot of sympathy. But Dulles, it was very powerful. Dean Rusk of Kennedy.
Oh, yeah, right.
And big on Vietnam, not considered one of the important or great ones. But then you get into, you know, these sometimes there's like with Nixon, he had William P. Rogers, but everybody thought it was Henry Kissinger. But Kissinger was National Security Advisor, and he only becomes at the end of Nixon's term Secretary of State, and then continues that with Gerald Ford. You know, so you get, and then look at Jimmy Carter, the rivalry between Zbigniew Brzezinski and Cy Vance, one a hawk and one more moderate on how to deal with Russians and others. And then done the, you know, recent ones with Bushes, like you mentioned, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, you know, have gone on to have stellar careers of their own being Secretary of State. And I see it a little less so now, but Tony Blinken's kind of got into people's consciousness, I think, at the time of the October 7th attack, Hamas attack on Israel. And he quickly came to, you know, Jerusalem and was able to talk to Israelis. And I think was a sympathetic shoulder at that key emotional moment in the conflict.
And over presiding over all, I guess, before we get to some of the other cabinet members, I meant to mention earlier, is the White House Chief of Staff, right? I mean, extremely important position. And again, we think about some of the ones who made their mark, Jack Valenti, right? H.R., for better or for worse, right? H.R. Haldeman, Donald Rumsfeld, Rahm Emanuel, right? Pretty big players there.
Big players of a different cut.
Indeed. Yeah.
The idea that White House Chief of Staff is to tell people no, tell people yes, wield a certain kind of instantaneous power, matters less of your intellectual acumen. It's more about your guts and political instincts. I think, you know, Rahm Emanuel dealing with getting the Affordable Care Act for Obama passed, working in tandem with Senator Harry Reid of Nevada and of course, Nancy Pelosi of California, scoring for Obama that key achievement. Rahm's all there every day working on that. He's now, of course, our ambassador to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you get H.R. Haldeman, you know, was the power in the Nixon White House. And Nixon was a two-termer. And Haldeman got indicted and did prison time for Watergate. But in the day, Haldeman was like a Doberman pitcher, in care of Nixon's business. And, you know, he exuded an extraordinary amount of power, much more so than any cabinet secretary.
Right. The one that sort of trips presidents up or can is the appointment of attorney general. I mean, that's a tricky one. What you want an independent attorney general, but you also don't want someone like Janet Reno who's going to appoint Ken Starr as a special prosecutor, right?
Well, that's a great point. I've never held it against John F. Kennedy that he picked Robert Kennedy to be his attorney general. It, of course, is the created nepotism laws that happened. It seems like something you shouldn't do. But yet today our Justice Department is named after Robert F. Kennedy. He did an extraordinary job during the Cuban Missile Crisis going after Teamsters and kind of set up a swashbuckling reputation for himself that some attorney generals tried to emulate. You don't, you know, it's always hard. I mean, look at, well, for what you mentioned, Janet Reno, you know, and, you know, suddenly she's coming in and picked, you know, says, oh, well, Ken Starr will do you good. Well, Ken Starr practically destroyed Bill Clinton.
Right.
And even recently, you look at the Hur report talking about Joe Biden's age and feebleness, that the language used in that report, and, you know, it was Merrick Garland who
appointed him, right?
Appointed him and so sometimes you can get done in by your own attorney general because when you're not Bobby Kennedy, just didn't give a damn.
Right.
But if you start trying to worry about your public perception and how you're going to be seen, are you judicial? And you'll find yourself often at odds with the sitting president if you can be seen more as doing the president's business. You last longer in the political sphere and you end up being, let's say, like Eric Holder was for Barack Obama, somebody who becomes sort of a giant political agent simply because that you're seen as being that closely married to the president.
Right. And of course, as we'll get to a little bit later, Donald Trump felt certainly betrayed by his attorney general, his first one, at any rate.
Donald Trump felt betrayed by everybody.
I think you're right.
I think it's the opposite. He betrayed everybody. It's like a flip.
I think
I've given up even trying to remember how many cabinet people Trump had. You know, he marched in a new Secretary of State a year. He seemed impossible to work with.
Right. We'll get to that just a little bit. So there are two more though. Before we get to Trump versus Biden here, you mentioned the first lady. Some first ladies, obviously not elected, but they've had a real, in terms of policy, right, a real impact on the presidents. We learned a lot. I was surprised to hear how much Rosalynn Carter, for example, was really involved in policy and some issues on her own. She traveled around the world. You mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, Nancy Reagan, very powerful. Edith Wilson, basically running the country for a while, right?
So, yep. And, you know, there was an artist named Judy Chicago.
Yep.
The 1970s did a large installation piece called The Dinner Table. And what she did was create a table with 37 women in world history that sat at it. And you know, it was a way to honor Cleopatra, Joan of Arc. You get the idea. And there in that 37 were two American first ladies, Abigail Adams and Eleanor Roosevelt. And Abigail Adams was a tremendous choice because she wrote so many letters as first lady that it is a remarkable trove of our country. And we're lucky we have them. And her husband wrote well too. Their correspondence is remarkable. But the way she would word and say things about our country and customs and what was going on in political currents of the time, she's really in a league of her own, Abigail Adams, as an intellectual, you know, a thought leader, first lady. Eleanor Roosevelt, by the sheer dint of being there for four terms and her pivot to trying to take care of working at improving the lives of Black America, of people underserved by government, being a feminist and fighting for women's rights. And of course, after FDR dies, she tries to keep his pet child, the UN, going, and she will be the one who authors the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And while she was president, she'd write a My Day column all the time. You'd be reading a column by Eleanor Roosevelt. So she was part of the consciousness of our times during the Great Depression and World War II. Probably no other first lady comes near her except Abigail Adams as an intellectual.
Mm-hmm. I just remember that great phrase of Abigail Adams, remember the ladies, right?
Yeah, I know.
And that was very early on, right? I think
it was
when they were writing, and telling her husband, remember the ladies. Yeah, I think. Okay, so here we go. Vice president. Which vice president do you think have really, I mean, I'm thinking about, for example, Dick Cheney, as much as I disagreed with him. I mean, he was a very powerful vice president, right? What others do you rate?
Well, Dick Cheney's a good one to evoke. I think it was the high water mark of Maureen Dowd's time as a columnist, painting him as Darth Vader after George W. Bush, because he seemed to be so cocksure of himself and very dominant that it almost seemed that Cheney was running U.S. foreign policy and Bush 43 was an underling.
Total.
That
right.
Feel was there for a long time. And I'm told now that there's some strain between Cheney and George W. Bush, because when you try to legacy carve, and it's not easy on Bush 43, the Cheney figure doesn't sit very well. Because it does seem like somebody that's usurping your power and perhaps leading you into a terrible mistake, which is going into Iraq under the auspices of there being weapons of mass destruction when there were no weapons of mass destruction. So Cheney is a great example of a power broker vice president who probably led his president astray.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there was a very healthy relationship between Reagan and Bush 41. I edited Ronald Reagan's diaries, which he kept every day. And one of my more surprising parts of it is how often he met Bush for lunch and would listen to him.
Really?
At the time, the media thought that Nancy Reagan and Barbara Bush didn't like each other, which is also true. But the two Republicans, Reagan and Bush, would meet for lunch regularly, routinely once a week, but then would have other private moments, and Bush got consulted on about everything. So I realized I was a lot closer and that Reagan was pulling for Bush more than you could have believed when he ran in the first time in 1988.
Right. So Joe Biden and Barack Obama, we know that they were not real close personally, but Biden, would you agree, does get some credit for something? I mean, certainly played a role in Obamacare, for example, in the stimulus that which Obama put him in charge of. So he was not just a flower, wallflower, or what's the word I'm looking for, right? Standing in the corner watching things.
Yeah, wallflower. Well, no, he wasn't a wallflower because, I mean, on something like he got ahead of himself, if anything, too often on gay marriage, which was big back then in the Obama years. He's the one who said we're going to do it before the president did. And it helps him a lot with LGBTQ voters as he's seeking re-election now, the memory that Biden was on their side early on. But they worked well together. They were really less of a team of rivals, more of a team of contrast. They really helped Barack Obama win by having a longtime veteran white politician from the Northeast who Lunch Bucket Joe or Amtrak Joe, somebody who could talk to the white working class, which was supposedly Biden's strong suit. And so I think they were enhancer. And over time, I would say that they became close, Biden and Obama. Again, less so now. There's some strain there.
Mm-hmm.
Biden does consult with Obama, but it seems like he spends twice as much time on the phone with Bill Clinton. Well, that might be correct, because Bill Clinton is a very shrewd political strategist. And if you're talking campaign politics, I would always listen to what Clinton has to say. But at any rate, Biden did a good job as vice president. Walter Mondale was very close to Jimmy Carter. He had no life after being VP Mondale. He couldn't track on his own. But yeah, there are times when these vice presidents develop an unbelievable closeness. Clinton and Al Gore were tight until Monica Lewinsky, and then Gore got kind of holier than thou and wanted nothing to do with Bill Clinton. That probably was a mistake. It would have allowed Bill Clinton to vigorously campaign for him in 2000. You may have had a President Gore now prioritizing climate change early in the 21st century instead of George W. Bush taking us into misguided wars.
Yeah, ironically, I think Bill Clinton could have helped Al Gore carry his home state of Tennessee, and we would not have had the problems in Florida. So it all then boils down to, let's look at, we're talking about people around the president, the cabinet, his top White House staff, how we would rate Donald Trump and Joe Biden in that category. But we're going to take a quick break first, Doug, then we'll be right back and pick up there with Trump, Biden, and their team. Today's podcast brought to you by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Yes, those good men and women, 1.3 million working men and women strong, members of the UFCW. Under President Mark Perrone, they service all of us in many, many different ways at our big retail stores like Nordstrom and Macy's, the people that take care of us at our great grocery chains like Safeway and Whole Foods, those on the front line in our meat and poultry processing plants, chemical plants, and cannabis plants. We thank the men and women of the UFCW for their great work taking care of all of us Americans, and we thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod. Go to their website, check it out at ufcw.org. You'll be amazed at all the good causes they're involved in.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back on today's podcast, looking again at presidential history and what we can learn from it for the big decision we face here in 2024. Our guest, nobody better than presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, professor of history also at Rice University. So let's look at Donald Trump, Doug. I mean, it's interesting to look at his cabinet, but at the same time, I think you alluded to this a little earlier. With Donald Trump, it was like, all about him, wasn't it? I mean, like, he thought he was the attorney general. He was the secretary of state. He was the secretary of defense. At least my impression.
And I keep that in mind when you're playing the sweepstakes of who's going to be Donald Trump's vice president. He wants nobody that's going to overshadow him in the media sphere. I think the idea of a Christy Nome is a non-starter. I know the idea because she's attractive looking that he's going to pick her maybe the way that John McCain did Sarah Palin. I would rule that out. I think Tim Scott's a possibility because Trump doesn't think Scott is all that bright. I think he thinks that Scott brings him evangelical votes and will not overshadow him. He'll bow to Trump. He'll tell Trump like he did recently how much he loves him in public, and that puts him in the running. And then I would keep my eye on a long shot like J.D. Vance from Ohio, because I'm feeling the drumbeat of these legal cases against Trump mounting, and it's starting to be real money being paid out, and it could get worse over the summer, and it might be to his benefit to have a lawyer like Vance, who was a Yale University superstar and then wrote Hillbilly Elegy. Mm-hmm. And now it just rubber stamps anything Trump and his Donald Trump Jr.'s closest friend, really close to Donald Trump Jr., J.D. Vance. And coming from the Midwest, he could be somebody that Trump looks for because he'll treat him as kind of the guy giving legal advice,
right,
defending him legally, which he needs. So he might go with it, but he's not looking for somebody that has anything near parity to him.
I have not done the heavy homework on this, but since I've been following the presidency, which is certainly since Ronald Reagan, I don't think there's been any president who has had as much turnover in the White House, turnover in the cabinet, as Donald Trump did in his 4 years. He went through four chiefs of staff, right? For example.
It's a revolving door of people coming and going. Everybody loves the idea that they could say that they were chief of staff or Secretary of State, and you're not there for long, and you end up leaving, disdaining the president because you were believing that there were some guardrails of government there, only to find out that Trump had no guardrails. There is no way to control the beast. And so you're kind of left as a feckless yes person, a sycophant. And if you're not that, you try to speak out and say something different, you'll be ostracized or driven out. So it's a hard and tough position. The one thing you know about Donald Trump is that you don't get the best people into the White House anymore. You're getting second-tier people.
What does it say to you that today, as of today, the only member, I believe this is correct, the only former member of Donald Trump's cabinet or top people in the White House supporting him for re-election is Ben Carson?
I think Ben Carson, I think Pompeo is too.
Is he? Yeah, maybe, yeah. Sort of, huh? Yeah.
But that's about it. And that tells you, tells you about Ben Carson, that he will be back in some sort of configuration with Trump. So will Pompeo. Not as Secretary of State again, I wouldn't think, but perhaps that, and perhaps some other major post. But those are the two I think of that it's for some reason didn't break the bridge to Trump.
But it is significant that, you know, even a Bill Barr, right, and then look at John Kelly, Mick Mulvaney, all of them now speaking out against Donald Trump, actually.
They're trying to tear Trump down.
Yeah,
they're feeling it's too little, too late. They're feeling that they should have spoken up earlier. They're living in a world of sin for having capitulated to Trump's style of authoritarian rule. So there's a lot of anger of the people that get demoted, fired by Trump. They become civilians again, and they want revenge and retribution. And alas, they don't have that much power because a lot of people think of them as an ex-Trump flunky. And the Trump, meanwhile, with his social media dominance, can send out a message, a tweet, as we used to call them, and just devastate these people. I've been amazed how Donald Trump has been able to take five-star generals and destroy them by calling them unpatriotic, treasonous, you know, dumb. You name it. There never used to be a time when a president would go after America's top military in such a fashion, but Trump does that, and he seems to get applause for it from the right.
Right. You know, he could call for the assassination of the former head of the Chiefs of Staff, and he could attack Nikki Haley's husband while he's on active duty.
There you go. And, yeah. And he's just getting warmed up at spring training. I mean, wait till if he got reelected, he will try to use that pure power against his political opponents. I don't think you're going to go after people like you and I, Bill. We're too down the line. But some of these kinetic figures around him that have been criticizing him, there's going to be a cost to pay. That's the Roy Cohen. That's the mafia. That's right. That side of Donald Trump, that he has his own list. It's not an enemies list. It's a list of people he's going to get revenge on. And so it won't be all reporters, all liberals, but he'll probably hone in on a Joe Scarborough or two.
Yeah, yeah. The Nixon list will look mild compared to his list, for sure.
Yes, it'll look very quaint. This one will be a brutal list with real things being done.
So we see all the chaos and the revolving door under Donald Trump. By contrast with Joe Biden, only one member of the cabinet has left to take another job, Marty Walsh from Labor. He's now back in some capacity, I saw just the other day. How would you rate the Biden cabinet in terms of, first of all, their significance or their what they bring to the table and their loyalty and steadfastness, if you will?
Well, their loyalty and steadfastness to Joe Biden is undeniable. They really have, if anything, they have created a kind of cocoon administration where they all try to stay on the same page, offer the same messaging. You're seldom getting a purposeful crossfire moment between them. So, even when you see Kamala Harris being a little harder on Israel than Joe Biden, that's all scripted. They're working together as a team. The downside I see is there may not be those no people or people that are challenging the orthodoxy within the administration. During the Vietnam War, when Lyndon Johnson was making many mistakes, there was Undersecretary of State George Ball, who used to go into the meetings and say the war is stupid and this is immoral, and they would hash it out. Nobody ever listened to George Ball, but at least some of those views were being heard. I don't think Biden wants to hear from those people, and that means he's kept isolated from his base. And they only seem to do these emergency meetings with the base when something happens in the polls. And that might be the short circuit in having a Biden administration that does seem to get along so well.
Do you have any read on the impact or influence of First Lady Jill Biden on these discussions?
I do. And she is one of the most powerful first ladies of all time. She's very, very much like Nancy Reagan. She has hawk eyes for who might hurt Joe. She's keeping an eye on people coming and going. She's reading people's body's language. She's listening to TV and seeing who may suddenly be 90% for Joe Biden, but is criticizing him now, and it fills her with ire. There is no Biden without her. She is his co-partner. In the same way that Ronald Reagan couldn't be cruel or mean or fire anybody, Nancy Reagan had to be the watch dog for Ronald Reagan. But in those two cases, you're having powerful first ladies because they're dominating in their thinking and have an inordinate amount of power over what their husbands are going to do and say.
Yeah. So we have been talking about, again, how a president makes those very important choices of the people that he, so far it's only been a he, has appointed around him, and whether or not he's listening to them, and ending up with a big contrast, of course, again, between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, with our guest historian Douglas Brinkley. Doug, thank you so much. When we come back next week, let's kind of wrap it up by looking at our more modern presidents, focusing on them, and also looking at Donald Trump and Joe Biden side by side. Each of them has had 4 years now. What can we learn from that? Good to talk to you again. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Thank you so much.
And there we go. Episode 3 with Professor Brinkley. So far, we've looked at what it takes to make a good president. Who are the best presidents and why do we consider them the best? And who put together the best team in the White House to help their presidency along. Now, we wrap it all up next week with Professor Brinkley, episode 4. We've seen 4 years of Donald Trump. We've seen almost 4 years of Joe Biden. Let's just put them side by side, apply all the lessons we learned from Doug Brinkley, and make our final decision. That's next Tuesday with Doug Brinkley. In the meantime, be sure to come back on Friday for our Reporters Roundtable, wrapping up the news of the week from our nation's capital with three of our top political reporters, what's ever happening in Congress, in the White House, around the country, in the political campaign. We'll take a look at all of it, try to make some sense of it all with three, again, of our best reporters. And we'll see you Friday on the Reporters Roundtable and next Tuesday, episode number 4 with Doug Brinkley.